Blog Talk Radio.
Folk out there. This is the converted Mets fan, Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the NL East preview part one of the Rising Apple Report. I'm very, very happy to be here tonight. We have less than a week away from baseball, and it's just it's an outstanding feeling. And I'm going to first bring on the Rising Apple crew before I bring on our guests to help preview both the Nats and the Marlins, respectively. And first, I'm going to start with the Brooklyn Trolley blogger himself, none other than Mike Lacolon. Mike, how are you doing this week of the end of March?
I'm doing well. Thank you very kindly. And in advance, let me just say hello to everyone because we got a lot of people on board.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And that's why we're going to bring on Rich Spirago of Rising Apple next. Rich, how are you feeling right now?
Well, feeling good, Sam. You know, we have a lot to talk about. Not only is it a preview, but there are some other things in Metsville to discuss. But the fact that we're talking baseball is great, and the fact that we are 6 days away, 6 days from this very minute, it'll probably be about the top of the second, and real baseball will be happening, and it's all good at that point.
Exactly, and that's pretty brilliant to imagine right now. And I'm going to bring on, I have a couple 917 numbers, and unfortunately, I didn't get one of our featured guests, Ricky Keeler's number, off the top. So I'm going to first bring on the person who first pulled in from the 917 area code. Last two digits is 26. You're here on the Rising App Report. Who I got here?
Hey, Sam, it's Ricky from District.
Ricky, thank you very much for calling in tonight. We look forward to previewing the Nats. It's great to hear from you. It's been a while. But I'm going to check in with our next 917 area code, last two digits, 70. I believe this might be Danny Abriano.
Yep. What's going on, Sam?
Hey, Danny Abriano, our site editor, and this is a good place to start because we have some news out of Mets camp before we get started with the Nationals, and that's about Matt Harvey and his non-baseball-related medical issue. If you want to debrief us a little bit on that, Danny.
Sure. And it's a little strange, the situation. Earlier in the day, there was a report that Harvey was a doctor for something that seemed minor. He skipped a trip to Jupiter against the Cardinals just to go get something checked out. And then later in the day, after the Mets game was over, Terry Collins was speaking in vague terms about Harvey, and then eventually said that he wouldn't be pitching tomorrow, wouldn't be pitching again for the rest of spring training, but said it wasn't an orthopedic issue, wasn't an arm issue. About 5 minutes after that, Sandy Alderson said that it wasn't even a baseball-related issue. So it's not a physical injury for him. Say what it was. Collins actually used some interesting terms, saying he can't disclose what it is. So at this point, we really have no idea other than it's not something that will prevent him from playing baseball in a physical way, but we don't know if he's on his way back to New York, and Alderson basically said we're going to wait to see what the medical reports are before reacting further. So Mets Twitter is freaking out. I'm sitting here with a glass of scotch, and I have no idea what the hell is going on. So that's where we are.
Rich, when was the first – I'm sure you've heard about this before even getting on the air. What's your take on the whole thing?
Well, you know, I heard about it around 4 o'clock, you know, everything exploded, and we all, you know, text each other, text Twitter, all those things, and here's my take on it. My take on it is, and I know that it's horrible to speculate, but it could be a medical thing. You know, we think about John Neese's heart rate, and we think about Reyes's thyroid. It could be something medical that's not baseball-related, you know, so, and the one thing, here's my first thought. These guys are human beings, you know, they have the same physical issues that any of us might have. So it would not be all that uncommon if Harvey had to be treated for something that anyone else could have that's not a baseball or sports-related kind of a thing. And we have to let it play out. You know, I refuse to freak out. I refuse to start going into gloom and doom scenarios about how, you know, we're going to get 10 starts out of Harvey and the sky is falling. And I'm not going to do any of that because let's just see what we're dealing with here. You know, it could be anything, and if it is something that could be controlled with medication or something like that, maybe he misses opening day, maybe he doesn't. But now is not the time to start worrying about it. So, you know, I'm in the mindset of let's find out what it is, let's figure out what the treatment plan is, and then determine the impact it'll have on the 2016 Mets.
Yeah, and if it's not baseball related, I definitely agree that, you know, it shouldn't be disclosed right now. It's a proper thing to do. Mike, we do need to get to Rick, but I just want to get your take real quick.
On another night, you know, I would have probably taken Rich's approach, but I'm feeling a little rambunctious today. Let me just throw a couple of things out there, food for thought. His last outing didn't go too well. A couple of people complained that, you know, his fastball only hit the high 80s. And, you know, quote-unquote, we've known the Mets to underplay certain situations before. And then all of a sudden we have a full-blown, you know, situation on our hands the next day. Like I said, that's just food for thought. I'm not necessarily buying into that. Who knows? A blood test could have revealed something, as Rich alluded to. But here's what I'm thinking, and this is more closer to where my mind is at. You know, 1 second, here we were, you know, with Matt Harvey's, you know, putting it out there. I think a lot of women would be impressed with my shoe collection, you know, which is to say that life was pretty normal a couple of days ago. And then all of a sudden, things turned on a dime. So I'm just real curious.
Yeah, so am I. And it's certainly some food for thought when we have a little bit more information. You know, obviously, this is just one of those vague Mets moments, and like kind of Rich said, it, you know, he's a human being, and I think it should be vague until they feel as if they can disclose it. So we'll see what happens. And without further ado, probably at first glance, I would say still the number one rival in the division right now. These are probably the top two tier teams of the division. And hopefully, you know, it was interesting what the Mets did to put another chapter in the Nats-Mets very young history of rivalry. But, Ricky, as you go into the next season, you got a new manager. There's new leadership. There's some new players, including Daniel Murphy from the Mets. What is the overall feeling of the fan base right now going into 2016?
I think there's a lot of anticipation with this team. You mentioned the new leadership. There's a different vibe when you follow the beat writers and a lot of vibe around the fans about Dusty Baker being here and about just the looseness that this team plays with. I know we're not really supposed to take a lot into the spring, but this Nationals team is 17 wins already this spring, so they're winning games. And Dusty Baker talked about it's better than being 4-17. There's a different speed element to this team. So far, everybody has stayed healthy, which didn't happen last year. Span was hurt in the spring. Rendon was hurt in the spring. And just everything, and Worth was coming off the shoulder surgery. So everything was just different last year with a lot of expectation. This year, it's a loose clubhouse, not a lot of expectation. So it'll be pretty interesting to see with another thing, a new look bullpen, how this all shakes out.
And I'm going to flip over to Mike now because he's somebody who brought up Jonathan Papelbon, speaking of that bullpen. Mike, go ahead and take it with your question.
Jonathan Papelbon, interesting cat. If Jason Worth and Jonathan Papelbon struggle, can the Nats win a division flag?
Jason Worth, yes. Jonathan Papelbon, no. I'll start with Papelbon. But getting rid of Drew Storing, they need him to be maybe not the closer he was a few years ago, but I would say the closer he was in the first half with Philadelphia. He wasn't bad with the Nationals last year in the second half outside what happened with Harper. But on-field performance, he did an okay job. But they need him to be that Phillies closer from the first half because you look at that bullpen behind him, guys are going to be in different roles like Sean Kelly, who they signed, Felipe Rivero in his second year. They got Trevor Gott in the Escobar deal. They have former Met Oliver Perez, Blake Treinen. There's a lot of different guys, and there's a couple guys competing for spots now. So this is definitely a new look bullpen. They're going to need Palabon, I think, to bring some consistency to that bullpen. As for Worth, he's not really, I think, he's going an everyday contributor based on the contract, but you look at the way his performance has gone down, and you look at what Michael Taylor has done this spring. He has been excellent both defensively and at the plate. He's stealing bases. He's the fourth outfielder going in because of the Ben Revere trade, but I would not be surprised if Worth, they played a little bit less, played a little bit more, because this is a Dusty Baker team with Davey Lopes as the first base coach. They're going to want to run the bases, and as long as some guys like Ryan Zimmerman stay healthy, I think anything that Worth would give them at this point is a bonus, but he's still a very good leader in the clubhouse. I just don't think if Worth was out this year as opposed to last year, it's going to affect the Nationals that much because there's a different style to them this year.
It's good to be talking to you again, Ricky, by the way. And I just got one more question real quick. Dusty Baker, I would be happy. It's an improvement over what was. So in that respect, yeah, I'd be confident. Now, that being said, has there been any sense whatsoever, always a bridesmaid, never a bride?
I don't get a sense that, Mike, and it's good to talk to you too as well, just because I think people look at Baker, remember the whole thing with Baker and Bud Black. People looked at, I was a little surprised about Bud Black because while he's good with pitchers, he hasn't really had the track record as Baker did. So Baker was my original choice from the beginning if I had to pick a guy. I know he hasn't won it all yet, but everywhere he goes, he has an impact, whether it's the Giants, whether it's the Cubs, or the Reds. He has an impact and gets his teams to win. I think Nationals fans are just tired of all the underachieving as they saw last year and the boneheaded move that Matt Williams made times like you guys saw benefited from firsthand. Baker, I don't think, is going to make those as many questionable decisions. He's going to let his guys play. He's going to trust his players. And I think having that guy that sort of can unite the players, because Matt Williams, you can tell, was just not really a player's guy last year. I think he's that big of a difference into maybe not getting the team to win 95 games, but getting them in a position to compete for the playoffs more so than Williams would.
And that, I mean, I think there's a lot of people out there, myself included, that would think that what they watched out of Matt Williams might be one of the worst managing, just consistently terrible stretches I've ever seen out of a manager. I mean, you know, we give Terry Collins a lot of crap, not only on the show, but a lot of Mets fans do too, even though he helped us make the World Series. And how about Daniel Murphy? What's going on with him? What's the vibe about him throughout spring training right now?
Well, I like the deal for Murphy. I mean, it's only a 3-year deal. I know that they gave up their first round pick to do it. They definitely, I think, needed an upgrade in the infield. I think something that's what Murphy does for them now that Rendon goes back to third, you have a proven second baseman. He fits this lineup because it adds another contact here to the order. When you look at adding Murphy and Ben Revere, who they got in the store and trade, they have two guys that don't strike out as often, and they're going to work the count, which I think plays into what the Nationals want to do. The question is defensively, as you guys know, and that's why I think Danny Espinosa is starting the year at shortstop over Trey Turner. Not that Turner can't play at major league level, because he absolutely can, but they want to get a proven defender to at least start the year at short in Espinosa, and he can still hit a little bit. I like the fact that Murphy can hit. He's not going to be the guy to hit in October. He's going to be, I think, a 15-20 home run guy. And you look at the fact that a couple years ago, he's one of the top stolen base guys. I think you might see Murphy run a little bit more in Washington as well. So in the end, as much as some fans don't like the contract, I think it's definitely an upgrade at second base, even though they moved on from a guy in Escobar who was supposed to play second, moved to third, and did pretty well last year.
And before I pass it on to Rich, I'm going to ask about follow up with the whole Jonathan Papelbon and Bryce Harper vibe among that, because I just remember watching some of the clips of the interviews in the clubhouse after the entire incident, you know, especially Matt Williams being extremely ignorant to the entire thing. I remember with Harper, it was very clear, he seemed extremely ticked off by the whole thing, and he didn't answer one question. He literally just kept saying over and over again, "I'm just worried about the next game. I'm just worried about the next game." That was his answer to every question. So I really thought they would try to get rid of Jonathan Papelbon. Obviously, Drew Storen really kind of collapsed, not only because of himself, but I think because of just the vibe that they threw him. What's the take right now between those two players and Jonathan Papelbon in that clubhouse?
Well, from listening to some of the beat writers and seeing what they've been tweeting, it just seems like it's a non-issue in the clubhouse right now. The players have moved on from it. Papelbon and Harper, I think, have moved on. Papelbon addressed it earlier in the spring, and I give him credit for at least doing that to start off, but he kind of had to do that. He knows he's not going to be loved by the fans, but that's what comes with what he did last year. I think they try to get rid of him, to your point, but nobody was really going to take him. At least they got something probably more than a lot of people thought they would have got for Storen. So I give Mike Rizzo credit for that one. My take, when you look at some of the contracts the Nets, when they couldn't get Zilbers, they couldn't get Hayward, they couldn't get, obviously didn't get Cespedes, everybody thought it was because of this whole clubhouse issue, and I lean toward more of the deferred money and the Madison situation, because I think of it like this. If a free agent told the Nationals, I don't want to come here because Papelbon is here, and the Nats really wanted that player, or Bryce Harper said, I don't want to play with Jonathan Papelbon, Papelbon would be gone. And I think he's still here because Mike Rizzo sees him as being valuable to the club. Now, he's also been helpful in the spring with guys like Gio Gonzalez. It's an interesting dynamic. Bryce Harper, I don't blame for kind of brushing it off, because at the same time, Bryce is one of those guys now focuses on an everyday thing. He addressed it in the past. That's part of his maturation process. While Harper's not fully become that leader like everybody wants him to be, he's been maturing more. So I think it's an issue that's over and done with, and I think the players are ready to move on, and Baker helps with that.
Well, thanks on that. Go ahead, Rich.
So, hi, Ricky. How are you?
What's up, Rich?
So my question is going to be around the pitching staff of the Nationals. So they, you know, they've lost a couple guys. They've lost Zimmerman. And Pfister, I know, was sort of a spot starter, not necessarily in the rotation the entire year. But so give us a feel for what your assessment is of the Nationals' starting pitching staff, minus Zimmerman, you know, relying on Strasburg and Gio. How do you see that? Do you see the loss of Zimmerman as being an enormous impact or something they could get past? Is there a hot shot prospect that we might see this year? Stuff like that around the starting pitching.
Zimmerman, I think, is definitely a little bit of a blow to this team. He was a reliable starter, was very consistent. They knew they weren't going to keep him, and the reason he signed with Detroit for the money he did. Pfister, obviously, now in Houston. But obviously, Scherzer's still going to be great. Gio Gonzalez, the question with him is going to be consistency. He did get a win yesterday in the spring, but he's also walked 12 guys in 5 starts. They're putting him in the second spot for now behind Scherzer because Baker wants to save the bullpen and split up Scherzer and Strasburg so you don't have to waste the pen as much. So I actually like that decision, but there's going to be a lot more on Gonzalez, and he knows it to be more consistent this year. Tanner Roark back in the rotation. So far he's looked pretty good this spring. He's been motivated being back in the rotation. Remember, this is the guy who won 15 games 2 years ago before Scherzer signed and moved Roark to the pen. So I'm expecting not what Tanner Roark did 2 years ago, but something a little bit less than those numbers. Joe Ross is another guy to watch. Last year was very poised in his first year. I'm going to be interested to watch the innings with him as the year goes on. He tired out at the end of the year last year. To me, there's two X factors in the rotation that could change the Nationals' course this year. One, of course, is Steven Strasburg. Last year, had a lot of health issues in the first half. Second half, he's one of the most dominant pitchers in the game. Stays healthy. He's the X factor in this entire division because he's in a contract year. We saw how bad the Nats players under contract years did last year. Maybe that changes a little bit this year. Strasburg kind of knowing he's going to be the best pitcher on the free agent market, arguably at the end of the year. He's going to want to get that big contract. Maybe that helps him there. The other guy is the prospect that you mentioned, Rich, is Lucas Giolito. Arguably one of the best pitching prospects, if not the best pitching prospect in baseball. He was in Major League camp, got a lot of buzz from teammates, from coaches. Watching a little bit, he was facing the Mets on SNY in one game I watched. He throws mid to late 90s with his fastball, good off-speed pitches. He's going to start the year, not sure where he's going to start yet, but I would think maybe in double or triple A. But the Nats don't have much depth because of the Bronson Arroyo injury. So if somebody goes down, there's a chance you might see Giolito early in the year. And a lot of people think that Giolito can be what Noah Syndergaard was for the Mets last year. So there's a lot of excitement around what Giolito can be. And he is the future of this team. Should Strasburg move on, it looks like he will. They're going to need him not only this year, but in the few years to come.
Good stuff. Thanks.
Hey, Tom, Rich.
That's great, Rick. We appreciate it, and we appreciate your time on here. I guess I'll finish with this, and I think this is a good transition. What is your take right now on the Marlins?
I think when you look at the National League, there's nine teams for five spots. I'm gonna include the Marlins as the ninth team. I like the Mattingly hire. Bonds is a hitting coach. And if Stanton stays healthy, him with Bonds for an entire year is going to be exciting to watch. I like the Chen move of the rotation with Fernandez. There's just a lot of question marks behind those two. And then you have the whole Torres Fernandez and his limits and how that might go. Their bullpen I'm a little bit questionable on. But I do think this is a team that will compete, at least maybe for one of those wild cards. But I do expect the Mets and Nats to have that gap. And I think the Mets will get the division. And I do think the Nats will get one of those wild card spots.
You know, I completely glossed over our site editor, Danny Abriano. So before I let you go, Rick, I do apologize to Danny, but Danny, take it away.
Sure. Just one last question. We obviously know that Jason Worth is going to be out there most of the time. Obviously, Bryce Harper most of the time. How do you see things shaking out between Ben Revere and Michael Taylor?
Well, Revere is going to start the year in center field. That's, I think, the reason they got him. They love the fact that he's one of those guys that gets on, that's going to steal bases, he gets on base, doesn't strike out, which is really the knock on Taylor. I mean, Taylor was shown great power, great speed, but he just strikes out way too much, and I think that was really a lot of questions on him going in. But as I mentioned earlier, he's been excellent this spring. I think you might see sort of like that rotation thing going. Maybe you get some Revere, some Taylor, and you sort of go back and forth because Taylor can play both left and center. But these two guys, remember, they're going to want to run. And you look at sort of like what we see with the Nats and Mets, and we talk about sort of the differences between the two. When we see those two play each other, I'm really interested to see how much the Nationals are aggressive on the base and bases and challenging Darnell with Revere, Taylor, maybe Turner when he's here, and trying to get some runs that way against that great pitching staff.
And that is interesting to bring up, considering that the way people ran on Travis Darnell in the World Series. So, that's going to be interesting to see. And, Danny, thank you for that question. And Rick, we appreciate you coming on and giving us a preview of the Nationals. And you know, we really look forward to the season. I'll give you this, since we always do a last word on here, your last word on the 2016 National League East.
Well, I think that the NL East, I mentioned, I think it's a two-horse race. The Marlins, I think, can compete more so than they did last year, but I do think it's the Mets and the Nats. Again, if the Nationals are going to want to take the East over for the Mets, which I think is going to be a lot to ask for, it's going to be going to come down to the speed on the bases and Steven Strasburg and how this bullpen looks. There's really those three factors to take a look at, but as I said earlier, I think it's going to be a much improved team from last year. I think it's a Nats team that can win between 86 and 90 games, and I do think two teams from out of the division go into the postseason, the Mets get the division, and I think the Nats behind Scherzer and Strasburg in this new-look lineup are going to get one of those two wild card spots.
Rick, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely, guys. Always a pleasure.
All right, later, man. All right, so before we bring on our Marlins guest, Sean, I'm going to go around the horn getting some last words on the Nats. Let's start with you, Mike.
Just, you know, curious. They're still a formidable team, and somebody put it very well today in our Kryptonite article that they're out for revenge. You know they took a misstep last year, and they're looking to make a correction this year. So look out for the Nationals, with Dusty Baker in particular, because Ricky said it very well. He knows how to get teams into the postseason. Teams play for him. You know, the fact that he hasn't won yet, that's a different issue. But Dusty Baker teams, you know, they're usually playoff bound. So look out for the Nationals. Don't take them lightly.
I would agree. Rich?
I also agree, and I think that it's not really widespread among the fan base, but I think there's a certain percentage of Met fans who think that the Mets are going to throw their gloves on the field and automatically be bequeathed the division, and I don't see that. You know, that Nationals team, they have a couple of good starters themselves. You know, Dusty Baker has a track record of success, even though not the big prize, so they aren't going anywhere. I mean, do I think the Mets are going to win the division? I do. I really do. But is it going to be a lay down or a lay up, whatever you want to call it? No, I don't see that. I see the Nats fighting them tooth and nail, and maybe the Mets winning the division by, you know, five or six games in the end, but certainly not a runaway. And, you know, that Nats team, you know, just to echo what Mike said, it's formidable. It's not going away. And, and they will be playing with a chip on their shoulder, and that's never good. So I think they will be a good club.
And I just want to throw out there, that was Michelle's point, by the way, that the Nationals are going to be looking for revenge based on, you know, their underachievement last year. So kudos to her. She's the one who put that out there. I just reiterated it for her.
I can
Michelle,
reiterate with
our co-editor. No, right. Michelle, our co-editor, I was actually thinking earlier about pronouncing her name correctly, but I don't think I can do it because I haven't listened to what is proper recently. So, Danny, not only will I go to you for the last word about the Nats, but I'll also go to you about the last word on how to pronounce Michelle's last name.
Pronouncing Michelle's last name, I'm 99.9% correct. It's Ayanu. And that's just from hearing her say it on the show once. And as far as the Nats, they made some solid acquisitions. But when you look at their 25-man roster, their expected 25-man roster, I think they actually got worse. And in free agency, they were spurned by Hayward, by Zobrist, by Seth. And while they have Giolito coming up, he's obviously on the way, but they love Zimmerman. So they're not going to be as good as they were in the rotation, at least early on this season. And, Mike, I know you bought into the Dusty Baker thing. He's going to have a nice impact, and maybe he will. But when I see Dusty, I see somebody ready to run young pitchers into the ground. I don't see anything more than that. Now, you know, will they be formidable? Yes, they'll definitely be formidable. But I just don't think they're on the same level as the Mets. I think most would agree with that. And if the Mets play up to their potential, they're going to win the East. And I really don't see any reason why we should be worried about the Nats. Again, they'll be good, but they're just not on the same level as the Mets.
It's worth noting, by the way, that the Nationals are having the best spring. They came into today with a 17-4 record. So, you know, take that with the pineapple, being that it's the Grapefruit League, you know?
Well, I mean, we had some wins last year. I remember that being a big deal. So we'll see. We'll see how the whole thing goes. It's all about, honestly, I think the Mets seem to understand that they still, you know, they got a target on their back, but they still have the work to do. This is not going to come easy. It's not the same team. If we really want to compare in some fashion to a recent history, it's not the same team going into the season as 2007. And that's something to really, really take to heart, because Terry Collins seems to, if he has any strength, is to keep these people level-headed. Even in some of their worst years, it was their talent and to an extent, Terry Collins getting the best of them in some of these years. But they never lost 90 games. And they kind of, you always knew that there was just one or two things that would have propelled them. I mean, look at the way they lost the Nats a couple of years ago at this point. So anyway, I think that the Nets have a good head on their shoulders. They understand nobody's going to roll over. The Nats are a different team. And like I said, Matt Williams was epic in his failures. And this is a good transition. I will start Sean off. And Sean of Marlin Maniac, welcome to the Rising Alpha Report before anything.
No, thank you very much. Just counting down the days here. How are you guys doing?
We're doing all right. You know, exactly. Counting down the days. And so before we go off on the Marlins camp, let's start with you on the Nats camp. What is your take from the Nats point of view in the National League East?
Mets point of view or the Nats point of view?
The Nats point of view, excuse me. Nats
Nationals.
On the Nationals.
Thank you.
I can't really argue with you guys. I do have to acknowledge that, I'd say you guys are the favorites for the division heading in. Certainly the Nationals have all the talent in the world on that roster, and that starting rotation is still terrifying. But they've sure found a bunch of ways to shoot themselves in the foot the last few years. Maybe they've worked on some of that managerially, but... So, I mean, I guess I still have in the back of my head until they prove to me that they're not going to implode, that I'm just going to watch them implode in September and fizzle out of it. But that could be bias. But I would say they'll be there till the end, but they'll be fighting with us for the wild card, not more than you guys for the division.
I like the general consensus going on right now, but hey, like I was saying, hopefully they're keeping a level head about the Mets. The Mets are. But so the Marlins, you know, there's been a lot going on. I know that there were some free agent moves, but it kind of escapes me off the top of my head because the Don Mattingly and Barry Bonds element of everything is so glaring that that is the thing that sticks out about the Marlins. I mean, it seems as if they're trying a different formula with the same ingredients. What's the fan base's take right now, and just overall about Loria?
I'd say it's guarded optimism. I mean, in terms of the Mattingly hire, certainly we've had a bit of a manager roller coaster these last few years. Stanton's played for 8 different managers if we count interim manager for a game. That's pretty ridiculous to say the least. But there's the cliche that managers are kind of overrated, but certainly they pushed that to the breaking point last season with I think I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night approach with making Dan Jennings the manager midseason. And I seriously almost applied before they hired Mattingly. But Mattingly on board, we're excited. He's got a winning, he's got a winning track record. It's a nice change of pace. So certainly there's always a concern that Loria might change his mind at the drop of a hat. But I think when the news broke, we did over-under bets on the site about how long he would last. I think it's about 2.5 years was the over-under thing and weighed in on either side of it. But we're excited about him. And Bonds, I think, is an intriguing move as well. And that was apparently Loria's idea. But certainly the players seem to be taking to both of them so far. Like all the buzz I've heard is players responding positively, players buying in, seeing a little more knowledge, professionalism in the clubhouse as opposed to last season. And so, we're... Again, guarded optimism is really how I would term it.
Yeah, I can certainly relate to that. Mike, I will start with you. Go ahead with your question.
Question. Giancarlo Stanton. I don't have to tell you, the Marlins and the Mets, the Marlins had an 8-11 record against the Mets last year. To me, that's too close for comfort. Now, Giancarlo Stanton only played in 10 of those games, and those games were all played before the trade deadline that we all know transformed the Mets. So that leaves a balance of 9 games down the stretch that the Mets didn't face him. Is that something that sticks out in Marlins fans' minds as one of those things like, you slipped one by us, just wait until next year?
I think in terms of looking at interdivision performance, the thing that probably kicks us the most is just the fact that, we had 9-10 records against the Phillies and the Braves too, so we're kind of just wondering how that happened, given their tanking for the future approaches. But all those games are close with you guys, so I can certainly see some of that. Of the 11 losses, I think only 4 of them were by more than 2 runs over the course of the year. So I mean, a lot of close ones, and certainly losing Stanton hurt. In terms of Stanton not being present, is really the overweighing thought for last year. Is just imagining what our year would have been like if we had Stanton for those 86, 88 games against the rest of the league. And then, his very small sample size of 74 or 76 games, he had 27 home runs. And that's the real haunting ghost from last year, is just what his stat lines would have looked like over 150, 160 games.
And in the 10 games he played against the Mets, he hit 5 home runs and hit and drove in 10 runs. I mean, that's just stellar. I'm going to throw this one out there real quick out of left field. I hadn't mentioned it to you before in our previous email, but Ichiro Suzuki, is there any kind of sentiment building for him? I mean, after all, he's only 65 hits away from 3,000 and only 2 stolen bases away from 500. Me, I'm a big fan of his, always have been. I think he's just a unique player, and is there anything building in the way of sentiment for what he's about to accomplish, and do you think he'll get enough of an opportunity to accumulate 65 hits?
Oh, absolutely. Ichiro is a very lovable figure in baseball. I think we all probably can go back to you know, memories coming up as kids watching him play. I went to, I'm living far away from Florida. There's only so many games I can make it out to, but definitely did get to see him bat. Got to say I saw Ichiro get a hit last year. It was probably the big thrill of my baseball season. Certainly, you know, his numbers were a little down from his career average, to say the least, but just watching him bat, watching Ichiro get a walk is just one of those beautiful baseball moments. And, yeah, fans are falling in love with having that presence on the team. I definitely think there's room for him to get that record this year. I'd be surprised if it didn't happen. Part of my reason for, you know, not coming on here and saying, you know, we're taking the division by storm is just that, you know, Marlins penchant for injuries these last couple of years. Until I see us have a stretch of miraculous health, I have no reason to think it'll happen. And I think with that way, Ichiro would definitely get those at-bats. He might even be able to get that record before September.
It'd be great to see. I think it'd be great for baseball.
Absolutely.
One of the coolest moments I've ever witnessed is when he got that, I think it is 262, the 260, or was it 200? Does anybody have the knowledge of that appropriate number? Does anybody have what did he break Sisler's record with in the year? Mike, Rich,
most
anybody?
Most 262. I think you had it on the nose. I just looked it up. 262.
What was the record number? What was the record number? Anybody know?
The record number.
I'm sorry. The record breaker. Excuse me. The record breaker.
Well, I don't know. You're weirding me out. But in 2004, he had 262 hits to set the record.
Right.
I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, on that note, while I look it up, I will pass it on to Rich Sparago to ask his Marlins question.
258, by the way. I just got it.
Oh, wow. There. Okay. Well, thank you.
So, hi. Good evening. And thank you for joining the Rising Apple Report. And so my question, the same question I had for Ricky on the Nats, which would be, I know as a fan of a team within the division, when I look at the Marlins pitching staff, I see Jose Fernandez, and I see greatness. And then I see Kohler. And so what I'm saying is I see, you know, kind of a steep drop-off after Jose Fernandez. And what I'd like you to do is assess it from a Marlins fan's perspective. How do you see the rotation past Jose Fernandez? Do you think that you know, these guys are coming into their own and you're expecting good things, or do you see it as, you know, it's Jose Fernandez and then they kind of have to piece it together after that? Maybe you can give us an assessment of Kohler and Nicolino and those guys and what you think of the depth of the starting rotation.
Well, I mean, I guess the interesting thing for how they're setting up their rotation this year is actually Fernandez is the number two man in their rotation, which, you know, on the surface would sound great. It would mean that we obviously have this amazing number one starter, but obviously that's just part of his innings management, that they're slating him into the two hole behind Chen, and that was our big free agent pickup. And him we're excited about. I mean, he's had a couple 3-6, 3-5 seasons back-to-back, innings eater in his own right. I kind of look at him as the good Tom Kohler, whereas Tom Kohler is just kind of, I call him the average Tom Kohler. He's honestly one of my favorite players on the team, but he's very much a workhorse kind of guy. I mean,
That's
fine. I like it. I'm going to make it a thing. I'm determined. But it's a steep talent drop off, to say the least. But as far as my biggest concern going into the year, the reason I was, you know, kind of guarded in my expectations is the back end of that rotation behind Fernandez, Chen, and Kohler. And Kohler, the last few years, has led the team in almost every pitching category. Yeah, we just can't have that if this is going to be a big season. He's got to, you know, Fernandez is going to have to lead him in many categories. Chen's going to have to be the leader in innings pitch. But the back part, Adam Conley's had a great spring. And that's one guy I'm excited to watch. Nicolino was demoted a couple of weeks back, but Conley looks to be the young curler of the group that's really is running away with it. His ERA this spring has been 1.186. It's been pretty impressive. He should have 10 strikeouts, but he had a rainout game. But in that rainout game, he struck out the first six Tigers he faced, you know, including some pretty well-known names. So I'm excited to see what he can do, but Yeah, 4-5 is piecing it together, but, you know, spring results mean anything. I'm a little more optimistic than I was at the start of camp. But, you know, that part, you know, we'll see what we can shake out at Jared Cozart, Adam Conley, Nicolino, like you said.
And thank you. Yeah, appreciate it.
Sure.
Appreciate it. Danny, go ahead.
Man, what's going on?
Hey, I'm good.
So,
how are you?
Basically, talk to me about Marcell Ozuna, because this guy is somebody who, when he came up, was one of your bright young hopes for the future. And obviously there were some issues last season in terms of how they handled him and sending him back to AAA for a time. So what's in store for him this season? Are things still kind of boiling over between him and the team?
Things seem to have smoothed over. I guess, you know, the fires have gone quiet on that front. It seems to, you know, be kind of buying into lessons as the new coaches are teaching him. Seems to get along with Mattingly. He's getting along with Bond. Certainly, it seems to at least be paying off on the field. He's just shy of 400 on the spring. He's one of the few hitters that's actually doing well this camp. And he's also been moved to the two hole in the lineup, which is a switch for him. They usually had him fifth or sixth, and they're putting him between Gordon and Yelich, two guys who, you know, could, you know, 200-300 hitters who can contend for the batting title. So he should see a lot more pitches, a lot more fastballs. And so, you know, I'm excited to see what he can do on the field. But yeah, that turbulence, and it's, you know, you kind of wonder on the back burner. You kind of have him in the back of your mind as one of two names that could be shipped out of town if this season goes south quickly. But I think a lot of that's, you know, been smoothed over. I mean, it's not like he was playing great when he was sent down.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting, Danny, bringing two sides of center field up from some of our division rivals. Ricky, in terms of the outfield, what exactly, you know, is going on? You know, Christian Yelich, I know, other than Giancarlo Stanton, of course, but Christian Yelich is another one of those that, you know, you look to for the future. But it didn't seem to happen as quickly as you'd hope. What's going on with somebody like that?
Yelich, I mean, his issues, he seems to like to start the season slow. And, you know, he finished with 300. The second half of the year, I had all the numbers in my head last weekend when I was doing my fantasy draft, but it's like some, you know, ridiculous, like in the top five and batting average and on base for the second half of the year. So I had to boost him up to that 300 mark. You know, and he's just, you know, in just a year, a couple years removed from winning a Gold Glove, kind of got that Juan Ligueras-type defense going on there for him in the outfield. So we're kind of waiting to see him put a full season together, but really both him and Ozuna, that's, you know, we're thinking, you know, you can see the Marlins, you know, contend this year, both of them kind of return, put forth their, you know, best season, so to speak, this year. I think the expectation is that one of them will, but maybe not the other for whatever reason. Yelich has been some, you know, back issues. Ozuna, there was just kind of that sophomore slump last year. But Yelich, we're excited about. He's a key piece of the team. And batting ahead of Stanton, we're, you know, hoping he could do some damage.
Yeah, and we'll see how that goes. I picked the Marlins as the kryptonite in the story that Mike was alluding to earlier. And it just always seems, no matter what your record is, you're going to be a pesky bunch, whether it be against the Mets or anybody else in this league, even though you put stretches together that build up a good amount of losses, including some against the Mets, as we collected some wins against you in the 11-game winning streak that started the season. Sean, you know, I will leave you with your last word. We appreciate you coming on and briefing us on the Marlin Maniac. What is your last word on the National League East?
Thank you for having me, certainly. The East, I mean, I do see it as, you know, you guys have earned the right to call it your division to lose. The chances of the Marlins making a run at you, it really comes down to health and just kind of reaching that next gear for a couple guys. And the things I've written about a lot in pieces this week is that of that opening day lineup card the Marlins trotted out last year, all nine of those guys missed significant time due to injury, or in the case of Salto Macchia, it was just cut because he was terrible. But, you know, they certainly had, you know, had a lot of roster issues the last couple of years. And if, you know, that can just level out, you look at Stanton, two freak pitches, you take those away, and we're probably talking about a guy going for his third straight MVP award. And just if, you know, the talent could stay on the field and just play full seasons, you get 25, 30 starts out of Fernandez, so 150 games out of Stanton. Ozuna returns to anything close to 2014, and it could be exciting. But I do see that being a lot to ask for. The Marlins probably, you know, settling in at 80 games behind the Nats and the Mets, and, you know, the Braves and Phillies could just duel for draft picks and look forward to 2017.
And I will leave you with this, since you brought him up. What exactly went so horribly wrong with a Miami native, Jared Salamanca?
That's a great question. I mean, it seemed like just one of those just great hires a few years back, and getting a guy with, you know, likable veteran in the clubhouse, fresh off a World Series experience. But then, you know, if you kind of looked at some of his numbers and a lot of areas that are already going down, and just, you know, he just never got it going. The thing that kept him on the team was that he was a little bit better than Jeff Mathis at the plate. But Jeff Mathis can play defense, and Salto Macchia just, you know, I think he led the league in errors in 2014. I just didn't really know what to make of that. So I actually considered it a sign of growth for the club when they cut him. He had $11 million left on his contract, and they just gave him his walking papers last season. And that was, you know, that's kind of money the Yankees throw away, not the Marlins. But I was kind of proud when we did it, honestly.
And that's perfect for the last word. Well done. It's always good when somebody like Jared Salamanca or Jason Bay is cut.
Thank you
so much for joining us tonight.
Sure. Have a great night, and see you guys on the field.
See you on the field. All right, guys. Let's wrap it up with the last word before we go back to the Mets. Mike. Let's wrap it up with the last word on the Marlins before we go back to the Mets. Mike, let's start with you.
Those slimy fish. You know, they've stuck it to us once. They've stuck it to us twice. They can very well stick it to us again. You know, never underestimate the Marlins. That's all I can say. They'll be there. They'll be there in the sense that they're going to pose a problem for us. Are they going to be in contention? Maybe for a wild card. That's not my point. You know, they're going to be a thorn in our side, like always. That's, you know, that's our lot in life.
Yeah, that's it. It's just what the Marlins' lot in life is. It's to be a thorn in the Mets' side, and I wish they would contract. Rich, your last word on them.
My last word isn't even a word. It's a symbol, and that symbol is a question mark. And it's the same thing every year with that team. It's, you know, going into the 2013 season, they had made all those acquisitions. They had gotten Reyes, and they had gotten they'd picked up Burley and all those guys, and you thought, oh, wow, this is going to be the year. They're going to win the division. And then they go out, and they absolutely poop the bed. They start trading off the pieces in the middle of the season. And you just never know with this team. Not only do you not know what they are going to do, you do not know what they are going to do to you in specific. So, you know, with the Nats, I feel very comfortable in saying they'll win 86 to 88 games and probably have a wild card. I feel very comfortable in saying that the Braves and Phillies will compete, you know, for who can get to 100 losses first. But with that Marlins team, I don't know. I mean, you know, they've got Stanton and they've got Yelich, but what else do they have? They have Jose Fernandez, but then there's a steep cliff in the rest of the pitching staff. So I just don't know what to expect from them, and that's why they scare us, because, you know, they're very hard to predict. And I'll close it with what Mike said. They're a slimy fish, and you can't keep your hand on them.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. Danny, what's your final word on them? I'm guessing close to the similarities.
Yeah, I know we've joked the last few years with this Marlins dream team thing, and writers, both national and local, picking them to go to the World Series and beware of the fish and all this nonsense. But, you know, I really do think they'll be solid. They have a decent core. Obviously, Jose Fernandez is ridiculous. Wei and Chen is going to be – should be a solid addition for them. And, you know, they were the team I picked as the Mets kryptonite, but I just don't think they have the starting pitching depth to seriously contend. Can they win 81, 82, 83 games? Sure. And I expect them to irritate the Mets as they usually do, and you know, by doing that, they'll obviously irritate me a bunch of times this season. But I just don't see them as being a team that can seriously contend just yet.
You know what? I got to jump on what Dan said. I don't have much faith in that starting rotation after Fernandez. Those guys are going to have a lot of early exits, and that's going to tax that bullpen. That bullpen is going to be hard-pressed come June. Already, you know, that's going to be they're going to be driven into the ground, and that's going to be their, you know, Achilles heel, their bullpen.
Probably, you know, I think it's just how it is. It's the Marlins are just going to be a thorn in our side. Bottom line, there's nothing we can do about it, and it's going to be interesting to see. I think for me, the most interesting thing to see about the Marlins is Barry Bonds, really. Don Mattingly, we know he can coach here, even though he's another one kind of like what you said, Mike, always a bridesmaid, never a bride. Even though he has a lot less years on his career than Dusty Baker does. But with Barry Bonds, this is just another hire like Mark McGwire of a steroid user, who obviously baseball is like, listen, you know what? They're very hypocritical with the entire thing. I can't disagree with some of the suspensions, but it's like, why didn't you get this under control in the first place? Oh, wait, you were making lots of money. But with Barry Bonds, the bottom line is he's a good hitter. We all know he knows the game of baseball, and baseball is recognizing that. And I'm very interested to see how it computes for some of these Marlins hitters. I'll transition us into the last part of our podcast with the fact that Long Island Mike is on the air. Long Island Mike, go ahead with you want to talk about regarding the Mets.
You sent me, right? Just want to confirm.
Yeah, I sent you, man. Yeah, that's you, Long Island Mike.
I was a bit sleeping on there. The Mets, like you guys said, the Marlins is going to be a pin in our side this whole year. They actually have a chance to win the division, in my opinion, if they're healthy. The Nationals, man, I don't like them. Just hit Bryce Harper in the head for all I care. Don't kill the guy, though. But Cespedes, I like what Kevin Long's doing, trying to get more contact from him. I would prefer contact over power. I don't know how you guys feel about that, but I would love to hear your guys' opinion.
Mike, we'll start with you. You know, I wanted to finish with the Mets, and Mike transitioned as well. Go ahead.
I will always refer back to my Reggie Jackson comparison. My friend Michael, Reggie Jackson. He's in the Hall of Fame. He hit over 500 home runs. He most famously hit 3 home runs on 3 pitches in the 1977 World Series against the Dodgers. Prolific slugger, won 5 championships, 3 with the A's, 2 with the Yankees. His offense was prolific, but he also led all of Major League Baseball history in strikeouts. There are some guys you just pay to do a certain thing. Throughout your lineup, you try to have balance, and you address a philosophy like a leadoff hitter, table setters, you know, guys that, you know how to move runners over. Then you want your slugger, and then you want your complementary hitters, and then you want your solid contact number 5 hitter, and you want, you know, you don't want dead weight in your number 8 hitter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What you get out of Cespedes is what you get out of Cespedes. We're paying for a certain commodity that he provides, and that's home runs. Don't change, you know, you can't change him. He is what he is. And we made the decision to make that purchase based on that. Now that we have him, don't try to change him. If that was your intent, you shouldn't have signed him. And I use you in the general term. You understand that. But he is what he is. The rest of the lineup, seek your balance there. Seek your strategy and your philosophy there. But don't try to tinker with him. Let him do what he does best. And that, as we saw over 2 months, August and September last year, worked best in the Mets' framework of what they were trying to accomplish.
Rich, what's your take?
Well, glad you brought that one up there, Long Island Mike, because I'm a huge fan of contact, small ball and speed, and I know that that kind of makes me a dinosaur in the way the game is played now, but I'll point to Exhibit A, Your Honor, and that would be the World Series. You know, the Mets had mowed their way through August and September with a lot of long balls, and that was great, and I love it too. I love a three-run home run as much as the next guy, but what you saw was the double-edged sword of having that kind of an offense, because when the home run bats go silent, you don't have another answer. And the bats went silent in the World Series. The other day, I watched the extra innings of Game 5. I watched from actually the bottom of the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th. And you know the Mets had one base runner in those innings because they were just sitting there waiting for somebody to hit the ball out of the ballpark. And when you have an offense predicated on the long ball and you go into a slump, you don't have a plan B. That's why, to me, if you have a Royals-type offense with a bunch of pesky guys, if one guy's in a slump, another guy can bunt his way on, another guy might walk his way on, and when they get on, they put pressure on the defense, they steal a base, they get into scoring position, they could score in an error. You know, I'm not saying my way is right, but it's the way I grew up watching the game, it's what I prefer. I think it's like having a stock portfolio. Why would you want to put all of your money in one stock? The way you do a stock portfolio is you balance it. You have different options. So if one's up, the other one's down. And to me, by playing that kind of an offense where you're not so much waiting on the long ball, but you have a bunch of guys who can get on, steal a base, do some small ball, so you could score even if a key player or two are in a slump, that to me has always been my preferred style. And as a Mets fan, it's exactly the opposite of what they do, but, you know, since you asked the question, I was happy to provide an answer.
Thank you.
Danny.
So Mike and Richard basically covered everything, and I agree with most of what Mike said. And you have somebody like Cespedes, and you paid him to hit the ball out of the ballpark. He's never going to be a guy with a high on-base percentage. He'll hit around 260. He's going to get on base at a clip around 315, 320, maybe 330. He's had a fantastic year. But this guy is paid to be a bopper. And I know that one of the things Kevin Long was doing was to try to improve his selection and hitting the fastball up in the zone. And that's great. If he can improve his pitch selection and be a little bit less vulnerable to balls up in the zone, that's fantastic. You don't want to go in there and try to retool what this guy's been doing. You don't want to go in there and tear things down. So, you know, you get what Cespedes, what he's been over the course of his career. If he stays healthy, he's going to hit you about 30 home runs. He's going to get on base at a clip that's a little below the norm, but the power is going to make up for it. And that's what we paid for, and that's what we should expect going forward.
And I would agree in terms of that high fastball. It seems as if, that high fastball is something to fish for, certainly. But Johan Epps could certainly use recognizing it better. He could also use recognizing that low slider that doesn't even hit the strike zone as it comes in. But at the same time, you're absolutely right. If you can figure out how to lessen his swings against that, but keep him aggressive against everything else that should be something to hit, it's going to be amazing. And, you know, I think we're going to see a stretch like we saw last year, because I think he does really like playing for the Mets, but I don't think we're going to see it in terms of the entire year. That was a crazy stretch that brought him to the best season he's ever had, by far. So it's going to be interesting this season, but I think that it's nice to hear that he's looking at contact, because I have to agree, Rich said it so perfectly, it's just a better way of approaching things, that when your home run swing isn't there, if you can shorten your swing, you know, if you can recognize, kind of be almost an intellect like Keith, who was never a home run hitter, but kept his bat level with the ball and kept the ball dunking in away from gloves. So that's gonna be good, guys. We're coming up to the it's 10 p.m. So I think it's a good time to wrap it up with our entire last word. And Long Island Mike, we appreciate you coming on and helping us segue out. We're gonna have a part two of this NL East preview, and that's going to be with the Braves and the Phillies, and that's going to come this Thursday. And, Rich, I'll start with you for the last word, considering I believe you're going to be hosting on Thursday.
I will, and I'll look forward to that. And with regard to the last word tonight, I would say, what's the word? It's not really anxiousness. It's more anticipation. What I'm talking about is the anticipation of the season starting in 6 days, but also, you know, I do want to hear what's going on with Harvey. I'm not going to contradict what I said earlier. You know, I'm not concerned at this point. I'm going to go with what they said, that it's not a baseball or a pitching-related injury, and that automatically makes it a hell of a lot better. But I do want to know what's going on, so I'm kind of going to stalk Twitter and stalk Adam Rubin on Twitter and all those folks and see when the news might break about what's going on with Matt. So, you know, a couple things to be on the edge of your seat about, and that's my last word for tonight.
Perfect, perfect. Mike, go ahead.
Ditto. My concern is over Matt Harvey. I remember what happened to David Cone, and that, you know, started out innocently enough. So, I'm not trying to create a worst-case scenario here. I'm just concerned. I'm curious. And I hope that we get some answers more sooner than later. And that really should be my final word. But like I said, I will take a portion of my final word every time I'm on this podcast from now on until they get it done. It's time to get a memorial made for Joan Payson at Citi Field. That is all.
No, you know what? That needs to be louder, not just from you, but from the entire fan base. So I appreciate you continuing to do it, and I am heeding your words, and I will get more on top of that as well. Danny, your last word.
Before getting to the last word, I'll mention Harvey briefly, but I'm not going to speculate or dwell like most on Mets Twitter are doing right now. It is consuming me. I am worried about what's going on with him. But we really can't do anything until we find out what exactly is going on. And hopefully, whatever it is minor. Obviously, Matt Harvey the person is much more important than Matt Harvey the pitcher. So hopefully he's fine and we find out what's going on quickly. And my final word for tonight is going to be finally. We've been waiting since the end of the season, and I was sitting in the stands when the hell of Royals fans sitting next to me screaming and cheering started to wash over me during Game 5, and since then I've been waiting for revenge. And obviously two games in Kansas City in April won't be revenge for losing the World Series at home in November, but I really just want this thing to get underway. We've been waiting, even though the offseason has been shorter this year because we went so far in 2015, this has been a long wait, and this is the first season in 10 years where the team has gone in as a World Series favorite. Last year was a fantastic ride, but nobody expected that to happen. And it's been building, and I'm just ready to get it going on Sunday night.
And that's this Sunday night. It's remarkable to think. And I actually haven't I haven't personally wrapped my head around it. But unfortunately, I'm going to be at work. But I will be right next to Rudy's, so I can probably pop in there, other than listening to the radio, just to take a look at it. And it's baseball's back. I can't even compute yet. Considering I've been taking care of rent and money stuff and taxes, as everybody knows, taxes is going on right now. I haven't even made the decision about going to opening day, home opening day, next Friday. Next Friday. Not this coming Friday, but next Friday. That's amazing. But I hope to be able to do it, and I probably will, let's be honest. And all out there, before we go, you know, we still have our three. Mike, I know you were saying not only on Gary's podcast, Mets Musings, we should shamelessly plug that, but you were saying on this one, you're kind of a walk-up guy now. Do you think you'll walk up to opening day?
I won't be walking up to opening day. No. I offer no explanation other than I'm just consumed right now with care for my mom. You know, that internally we know that, but, you know, that's where I'll be. That's where my attention is. So probably come May, you know, those urges will start hitting me. And like I said on his show and several times on the show, it doesn't really hit me until late afternoon, 2:33. That's when sentiments are triggers, and I say, "Ooh, I gotta get to a Met game and come home, change, go to a Met game, and I show up." That's how it's done nowadays, and that's, you know, it gets me there 10 to 15 times on a good year.
Exactly, Rich. How about you?
Well, I will be at opening day, and actually, my plans for opening day pretty much began on November 2nd of last year, when the group I go with, we started talking about, you know, what kind of tailgating are we going to do, and what time do we have to be in the ballpark to see the pennant rise and all that stuff. So to me, going on opening day, I haven't missed one in a really long time. And this year especially, seeing that it's a very special one, there's no way in hell I would miss it. And just looking forward to a fun day and, you know, being around the fans again and hang out with people in the parking lot, making some new best friends. So it's something I've been looking forward to for 5 months.
Rich, I have a bike now, and the only thing I can imagine next week is biking, starting at like 8, 9 a.m. as early as I possibly can, because I know it's like probably a 1 o'clock start. I don't expect to miss this because it's 2016, the Mets are starting. I haven't really written about it too much this season, but I want to going into 2016. I mean, in the off season, excuse me. And so I expect to be there. And Danny, I have a feeling, yes, you will be there.
Your feeling is correct. I've been going pretty much every year for the last, I don't know, 15, 16 years, ever since I've had a ticket plan since high school. And, yeah, this year is no different. I'll be there. I usually try to get there extremely early, maybe 9:30, 10 o'clock, do some tailgating in the parking lot. And recently, obviously, McFadden is out there, so I usually try to get in there, take advantage of some of their deals, some of the nonsense and shenanigans that goes on in that place, and then into the ballpark for introductions and first pitch and all that good stuff. And it's been a long wait, but I'm extremely pumped to get back out to Citi Field.
And get out to Citi Field, we all will. Guys, I think that's a good segue out of our first preview of the National League East. We're going to have the Phillies and Braves on next, the fan-sided folks of those respective blogs next time as well, and that's going to be Thursday. So make sure you tune in. Everybody, thank you for listening. And as always, let's go Mets.
Let's go Mets. Good night, boys.
Let's go Mets.
Let's go Mets. Good night, everybody.